In the 12th century, the great Kurdish conqueror Saladin built the citadel, a fortress on a hill above Cairo, using the labor of captured crusaders. For 700 years, the fortress served as the seat of government. The structure also contained several mosques and a prison. When the security forces brought people here, they took off their clothes, handcuffed them, blindfolded them, then started beating them with sticks and slapping them on the face. The Islamist attorney Montasser al-Zayat, who was imprisoned with Zawahiri, told me, "Ayman was beaten all the time, every day," Zayat said. They sensed that he had a lot of significant information. Jolly and devious, Zayat is an appealingly slippery figure. He has a large belly, and he always wears a coat and tie, even in the Cairo heat. In the fundamentalist style, he keeps his hair cropped close and his beard long and untrimmed. For years, he has been the main source of information about Zawahiri and the Islamist movement in both the Egyptian and the Western press. As we walked through the old prison, which is now part of the police museum, Zayat talked about his time there and recalled hearing the voices of tourists who were always just outside the prison walls. He pointed to the stone cell where Zawahiri was held, an enclosure of perhaps 4 feet by 8. "I didn't know him before we were brought here, but we were able to talk through a hole between our cells," Zayat said. "We discussed why the operations failed. He told me that he hadn't wanted the assassination to take place. He thought they should have waited and plucked the regime from the roots through a military coup. He was not that bloodthirsty." Zayat believed that the traumatic experiences suffered by Zawahiri during his 3 years in prison transformed him from a relative moderate in the Islamist underground into a violent extremist. He and other witnesses point to what happened to Zawahiri's relationship with Issam al-Kamari, who had been his close friend and a man he greatly admired. Immediately after Zawahiri's arrest, officials in the Interior Ministry began grilling him about Kamari's whereabouts. In their relentless search for Kamari, they threw the Zawahiri family out of their house, then tore up the floors and pulled down the wallpaper looking for evidence. They also waited by the phone to see if Kamari would call. "They waited for 2 weeks," Omar Azam told me. Finally, a call came. The caller identified himself as Dr. Issam and asked to meet Zawahiri. A police officer, pretending to be a family member, told Dr. Issam that Zawahiri was not there. The caller suggested, "Have Ayman pray the Maghreb, the sunset prayer, with me," at a mosque they both knew. Under interrogation, Zawahiri admitted that Dr. Issam was actually Kamari, and he also confirmed that Kamari had supplied him with weapons. Kamari was still unaware that Zawahiri was in custody when he called the Zawahiri home and made a date for the two of them to meet at the Zawiya Mosque in Mbaba. The police arrested Kamari when he arrived at the mosque. In Zawahiri's memoir, the closest he comes to confessing this betrayal is an oblique reference to the humiliation of imprisonment. "The toughest thing about captivity is forcing the mujahid, under the force of torture, to confess about his colleagues, to destroy his movement with his own hands, and offer his and his colleagues' secrets to the enemy." Kamari was given a 10-year sentence. "He received the news with his unique calmness and self-composure," Zawahiri recalls. "He even tried to comfort me, and said, 'I pity you for the burdens you will carry.'" Perversely, after Zawahiri testified against Kamari and 13 others, the authorities placed the two of them in the same cell. Kamari was later killed in a shootout with the police, after escaping from prison. Zawahiri was defendant number 113 of more than 300 militants accused of aiding in the assassination of Sadat and of various other crimes as well. In Zawahiri's case, possession of a gun. Nearly every notable Islamist in Egypt was implicated in the plot. The defendants, some of whom were adolescents, were kept in a zoo-like cage that ran across one side of a vast improvised courtroom set up in the exhibition grounds in Cairo, where fairs and conventions are often held. International news organizations covered the trial, and Zawahiri, who had the best command of English among the defendants, was designated as their spokesman. Video footage that was shot during the opening day of the trial, December 4, 1982, shows the 300 defendants, illuminated by the lights of TV cameras, chanting, praying, and calling out desperately to family members. Finally, the camera settles on Zawahiri, who stands apart from the chaos with a look of solemn, focused intensity. 31 years old, he is wearing a white robe and has a gray scarf thrown over his shoulder. At a signal, the other prisoners fall silent, and Zawahiri cries out, "Now we want to speak to the whole world! Who are we? Who are we? Why they bring us here? And what we want to say? About the first question, we are Muslims. We are Muslims who believe in their religion. We are Muslims who believe in their religion, both in ideology and practice. And hence, we tried our best to establish an Islamic state and an Islamic society." The other defendants chant in Arabic, "There is no God but God." Zawahiri continues in a fiercely repetitive cadence, "We are not sorry. We are not sorry for what we have done for our religion, and we have sacrificed. And we stand ready to make more sacrifices." The others shout, "There is no God but God." Zawahiri continues, "We are here. The real Islamic front and the real Islamic opposition against Zionism, communism, and imperialism." He pauses. Then, "And now, as an answer to the second question, why did they bring us here? They bring us here for two reasons. First, they are trying to abolish the outstanding Islamic movement. And secondly, to complete the conspiracy of evacuating the area in preparation for the Zionist infiltration." The others cry out, "We will not sacrifice the blood of the Muslims for the Americans and the Jews." The prisoners pull off their shoes and raise their robes to expose the marks of torture. Zawahiri talks about the torture that took place in the dirty Egyptian jails, where we suffered the severest inhuman treatment. There they kicked us, they beat us, they whipped us with electric cables, they shocked us with electricity, they shocked us with electricity, and they used the wild dogs, and they used the wild dogs. And they hung us over the edges of the doors. Here he bends over to demonstrate, "with our hands tied at the back. They arrested the wives, the mothers, the fathers, the sisters, and the sons." The defendants chant, "The army of Muhammad will return, and we will defeat the Jews." The camera captures one particularly wild-eyed defendant in a green kaftan as he extends his arms through the bars of the cage, screams, and then faints into the arms of a fellow prisoner. Zawahiri calls out the names of several prisoners who, he says, died as a result of torture. "So where is democracy?" he shouts. "Where is freedom? Where is human rights? Where is justice? Where is justice? We will never forget. We will never forget. Zawahiri's reference to dogs has a special significance in Muslim culture, where dogs occupy a lowly place next to pigs in their filthy natures. I spoke to an Arab-American FBI agent who has spent a lot of time in Egypt. He told me that the Egyptian police bragged of a technique they used of stripping a prisoner naked, tying him backward over a chair, and letting the dogs fuck him. Zawahiri's allegations of torture were supported by the testimony of an intelligence officer who said that he had seen Zawahiri, his head shaved, his dignity completely humiliated, undergoing all sorts of torture. The officer went on to say that he had been part of Zawahiri's interrogation when another prisoner was brought in. The officers demanded that Zawahiri confess to complicity in the assassination plot in front of his fellow conspirator. When the other prisoner said, "How can you expect him to confess when he knows that the penalty is death?" Zawahiri replied, "The death penalty is more merciful than torture." Zawahiri was convicted of dealing in weapons and received a 3-year sentence, which he had nearly finished serving by the time the trial ended. Released in 1984, Zawahiri emerged a hardened radical whose beliefs had been hammered into brilliant resolve. Saad Eddin Ibrahim, the American University sociologist, spoke with Zawahiri after his release and conjectured that he emerged with an overwhelming desire for revenge. "Torture does have that effect on people," he told me. "Many who turn fanatic have suffered harsh treatment in prison. It also makes them extremely suspicious." Torture had other unanticipated effects on these extremely religious men. Many of them said that after being tortured, they had had visions of being welcomed by saints into paradise and of the just Islamic society that had been made possible by their martyrdom. Ibrahim had done a study of political prisoners in Egypt in the 1970s. According to his research, most of the Islamist recruits were young men from villages who had come to one of the cities for schooling. The majority were sons of middle-level government bureaucrats. They were ambitious and tended to be drawn to the fields of science and engineering, which accept only the most qualified students. They were not the alienated, marginalized youth that a sociologist might have expected. Instead, Ibrahim wrote, they were model young Egyptians. Ibrahim attributed the recruiting success of the militant Islamist groups to their emphasis on brotherhood, sharing, and spiritual support, which provided a soft landing for the rural migrants to the city. Zawahiri, who had read the study in prison, heatedly disagreed. "You have trivialized our movement by your mundane analysis," he told Ibrahim. "May God have mercy on you." Zawahiri decided to leave Egypt, worried perhaps about the political consequences of his testimony in the case against the intelligence unit. According to his sister Heba, who is a professor of oncology at the National Cancer Institute at Cairo University, he thought of applying for a surgery fellowship in England. Instead, he arranged to work at a medical clinic in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. At the Cairo airport, he ran into his friend Abdallah Schleifer. "Where are you going?" Schleifer asked. "Saudi," said Zawahiri, who appeared relaxed and happy. The two men embraced. "Listen, Ayman," Schleifer said, "stay out of politics." "I will," Zawahiri promised. "I will." Zawahiri arrived in Jeddah in 1985. At 34, he was a formidable figure. He had been a committed revolutionary and a member of an Islamist underground cell for more than half his life. His political skills had been honed by prison debates, and he had discovered in himself a capacity and a hunger for leadership. He was pious, determined, and embittered. Osama bin Laden, who was based in Jeddah, was 28 and had lived a life of boundless wealth and pleasure. His family's company, the multinational and broadly diversified Saudi bin Laden Group, was one of the largest companies in the Middle East. Osama was a wan and gangly young man, estimated to be 6'5", and was by no means perceived to be the charismatic leader he would eventually become. He lacked the underground experience that Zawahiri had, and, apart from his religious devotion, had few settled beliefs. But he had been radicalized by the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979, and he had already raised hundreds of millions of dollars for the Mujahideen resistance. You have the desert-rooted streak of bin Laden coming together with the more modern Zawahiri, Saad Eddin Ibrahim observed. But they were both politically disenfranchised, despite their backgrounds. There was something that resonated between these two youngsters on the neutral ground of faraway Afghanistan. There, they tried to build the heavenly kingdom that they could not build in their home countries. In the mid-80s, the dominant Arab in the war against the Soviets was Sheikh Abdullah Azam, a Palestinian theologian who had a doctorate in Islamic law from Al-Azhar University. He is not related to the Azam family of Zawahiri's mother. Azam got a job leading prayers at King Abdulaziz University in Jeddah, where bin Laden was a student. As soon as Azam heard about the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, he moved to Pakistan. He became the gatekeeper of jihad and its main fundraiser. His formula for victory was, "Jihad and the rifle alone, no negotiations, no conferences, and no dialogues." Many of the qualities that people now attribute to bin Laden were seen earlier in Abdullah Azam, who became his mentor. Azam was the embodiment of the holy warrior, which in the Muslim world is as popular a heroic stereotype as the samurai in Japan or the cowboy in America. His long beard was vividly black in the middle and white on either side, and whenever he talked about the war, his gaze seemed to focus on some glorious interior vision. "I reached Afghanistan and could not believe my eyes," Azam says in a recruitment video produced in 1988 as he holds an AK-47 rifle in his lap. "I traveled to acquaint people with jihad for years. We were trying to satisfy the thirst for martyrdom. We are still in love with this." Azam was a frequent speaker at Muslim rallies, even in the United States, where he came to raise money. When bin Laden first came to Peshawar, he stayed at Azam's guest house. Together, they set up the Maktab al-Khadamat, or Services Bureau, to recruit and train resistance fighters. Peshawar had changed in the 5 years since Zawahiri had last been there. The city was congested and rife with corruption. As many as 2 million refugees had flooded into the northwest frontier province, turning Peshawar, the capital, into the prime staging area for the resistance. The United States was contributing approximately $250 million a year to the war, and the Pakistani Intelligence Service was distributing arms to the numerous Afghan warlords who all maintained offices in Peshawar. A new stream of American and Pakistani military advisors had arrived to train the Mujahideen, aid workers and freelance mullahs and intelligence agents from around the world had set up shop. Peshawar was transformed into this place where whoever had no place to go went, Osama Rushdie, one of the young Egyptian jihadis, remembered. It was an environment in which a person could go from a bad place to a worse place, and eventually into despair. Across the Khyber Pass was the war. The young Arabs who came to Peshawar prayed that their crossing would lead them to martyrdom, and then to paradise. Many were political fugitives from their own countries, and as stateless people, they naturally turned against the very idea of a state. They saw themselves as a great borderless posse whose mission was to defend the entire Muslim people. This army of so-called Afghan Arabs soon became legendary throughout the Islamic world. Some experts have estimated that as many as 50,000 Arabs passed through Afghanistan during the war against the Soviets. However, Abdullah Anas, an Algerian mujahid who married one of Abdullah Azam's daughters, says that there were never more than 3,000 Arabs in Afghanistan, and that most of them were drivers, secretaries, and cooks, not warriors. The war was fought almost entirely by the Afghans, not the Arabs, he told me, according to Hani al-Sibai, an alleged leader of al-Jihad. He denies it. Now living in exile, there were only some 500 Egyptians. They were known as the thinkers and the brains, Sibai said. The Islamist movement started with them. Zawahiri's brother, Mohammed, who had loyally followed him since childhood, joined him in Peshawar. The brothers had a strong family resemblance, though Mohammed was slightly taller and thinner than Ayman, another colleague from the underground days in Cairo. A physician named Saeed Imam arrived, and in 1987, according to Egyptian intelligence, the three men reorganized al-Jihad. Zawahiri's wife, Azza, set up house in Peshawar. Azza's mother, Nabila Galal, visited her daughter in Pakistan three times, the last time in 1990. They were an unusually close family and always moved together as one unit, she told a reporter for the Egyptian magazine Ahersa in December 2001. While Zawahiri was in prison after the assassination of Sadat, Nabila took care of Azza and her first child, Fatima, who was born in 1981. She visited Azza again a few years later in Saudi Arabia to attend the birth of Umayma, who was named after Zawahiri's mother. One day, I got a letter from Azza, and I felt intense pain as I read the words, Nabila recalled. She wrote that she was to travel to Pakistan with her husband. I wished that she would not go there, but I knew that nobody can prevent fate. She was well aware of the rights her husband held over her and her duty toward him, which is why she was to follow him to the ends of the earth. In Pakistan, Azza gave birth to another daughter, Nabila, in 1986. A fourth daughter, Khadija, arrived the following year, and in 1988, the Zawahiri's only son, Mohammed, was born. Nearly 10 years later, in 1997, another daughter, Aisha, arrived. Azza and her family lived a good life in Peshawar, her brother Essam told me. They had a two-story villa with three or four bedrooms upstairs. One of the rooms was always available for visitors, and they had a lot of visitors. If they had money left over, they gave it to the needy. They were happy with very little. Unlike the other leaders of the Mujahideen, Zawahiri did not pledge himself to Sheikh Abdullah Azam when he arrived in Afghanistan. From the start, he concentrated his efforts on getting close to bin Laden. He soon succeeded in placing trusted members of al-Jihad in key positions around the wealthy young Saudi. According to the Islamist attorney Montasser al-Zayat, Zawahiri completely controlled bin Laden. The largest share of bin Laden's financial support went to Zawahiri and the Jihad organization, while he supported the Islamic group only with tiny morsels. Zawahiri must have recognized, perhaps even before bin Laden himself did, that the future of the Islamic movement lay with this heaven-sent man, as Abdullah Azzam called bin Laden. Azzam soon felt the gravitational force of Zawahiri's influence over his protege. "I don't know what some people are doing here in Peshawar," Azzam complained to his son-in-law, Abdullah Anas. "They are talking against the Mujahideen. They have only one point, to create fitna, discord, between me and these volunteers." He singled out Zawahiri as one of the troublemakers. An Egyptian filmmaker, Essam Deraz, who worked in Afghanistan between 1986 and 1988, received special permission to visit the Mujahideen's main base camp in a complex of caves in the Hindu Kush Mountains known as Masada, the Lion's Den. "It was snowing when we arrived at the Lion's Den," Deraz told me. "The Arabs hated anybody with cameras because of their concern for security, so they stopped me from entering the cave. I was with my crew, and we were standing outside in the snow until I couldn't move my legs. Finally, one of the Arabs said that I could come in, but my crew must stay out. I said, either we all come in or we all stay out. They disappeared and came back with Dr. Abdel Muiz." The name was Zawahiri's nom de guerre. In Arabic, Abdel means slave, and Muiz, one of the 99 names of God, means bestower of honor. The man who called himself Dr. Abdel Muiz insisted that Deraz and his crew come into the cave, where he served them tea and bread. He was very polite and very refined, Deraz said. I could tell that he was from a good background by the way he apologized for keeping us outside. That night, Deraz slept on the floor of the cave next to Zawahiri. Deraz observed that bin Laden had become dependent on Zawahiri's medical care. Bin Laden had low blood pressure, and sometimes he would get dizzy and have to lie down, Deraz told me. Ayman came from Peshawar to treat him. He would give him a checkup and then leave to go fight. Deraz recalls that during one of the most intense battles of the war, he and the two men were huddled in a cave near Jalalabad with a group of fighters. "The bombing was very heavy," Deraz said. "Bin Laden had his arm stretched out, and Zawahiri was preparing to give him glucose. Whenever the doctor was about to insert the needle, there was a bombing, and we would all hit the ground. When the bombing stopped for a while, Zawahiri would set up the glucose stand again, but as soon as he picked up the bottle, there would be another bombing. So one person said, 'Don't you see? Every time you pick up the bottle, we are bombed.' And another said, 'In Islam, it is forbidden to be pessimistic.' But then it happened again. So the pessimistic one got up very slowly and threw the glucose bottle out of the cave. We all laughed. Even bin Laden was laughing." Bin Laden sometimes came to lecture at the hospital where Zawahiri worked. Although the two men had different goals, they had much in common. They were both very modern men, members of the educated and technological class. They were both from families that were very well known throughout the Arab world. They were soft-spoken, devout, and politically stifled by the regimes in their own countries. Each man filled a need in the other. Zawahiri wanted money and contacts, which bin Laden had in abundance. Bin Laden, an idealist given to causes, sought direction. Zawahiri, a seasoned propagandist, supplied it. The Egyptian had little interest in Afghanistan except as a staging area for the revolution in his own country. Bin Laden's main interest was in expelling the infidel invader from a Muslim land. But he also nursed an ill-formed longing to punish America and the West for what he believed were crimes against Islam. The dynamic of the two men's relationship made Zawahiri and bin Laden into people they would never have been individually. Moreover, the organization they would create, Al-Qaeda, would be a vector of these two forces, one Egyptian and one Saudi. Each would have to compromise in order to accommodate the goals of the other. As a result, Al-Qaeda would take a unique path, that of global jihad. Bin Laden's final break with Abdullah Azzam came in a dispute over the scope of jihad. Bin Laden envisioned an all-Arab legion, which eventually could be used to wage jihad in Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Sheikh Abdullah strongly opposed making war against fellow Muslims. Zawahiri undermined Azzam's position by spreading rumors that he was a spy. Zawahiri said he believed that Abdullah Azzam was working for the Americans, Osama Rushdie told me. Sheikh Abdullah was killed that same night. On November 24, 1989, Azzam and two of his sons were blown up by a car bomb as they were driving to a mosque in Peshawar. Although no one has claimed credit for the killings, many have been blamed, including Zawahiri himself and even bin Laden. The next day, Zawahiri was at Azzam's funeral, praising the martyred sheikh, as did his many other jubilant enemies. In 1989, after 10 years of warfare, the Soviets gave up and pulled their forces out of Afghanistan. More than 1 million Afghans, 8% of the country's population, had been killed, and hundreds of thousands had been maimed. Out of some 13 million Afghans who survived the war, almost half were refugees. And yet the war against the Soviets was only the beginning of the Afghan tragedy. After the Soviet pullout, many of the Afghan Arabs returned home or went to other countries carrying the torch of Islamic revolution. In the Balkans, ethnic hostility among Muslims, Croats, and Serbs prompted Bosnia-Herzegovina to vote to secede from Yugoslavia. That set off a 3-year war in which 150,000 people died. In November of 1991, the largely Muslim region of Chechnya declared its independence from Russia, an act that soon led to war. In 1992, civil war broke out in Algeria when the government canceled elections to prevent the Islamist party from taking power, a conflict that took as many as 200,000 lives. In Egypt, the Islamic group launched a campaign against tourism and Western culture in general, burning and bombing theaters, bookstores, and banks, and killing Christians. We believe in the principle of establishing Sharia, even if this means the death of all mankind, one of the Islamic group leaders later explained. And the war in Afghanistan continued. Only now it was Muslims fighting Muslims for political control. Bin Laden had returned to Saudi Arabia, ostensibly to work in the family business. In 1990, however, Saddam Hussein ordered the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. Bin Laden, who had achieved mythic status in his country because of his role in the Soviet-Afghan war, went to the royal family and offered to defend the Saudi oil fields with his Mujahideen companions. The rulers decided to put their faith in an American-led coalition instead, reportedly promising bin Laden that the foreigners would leave as soon as the war was over. But American forces were still in Saudi Arabia a year after the Gulf War ended, and bin Laden felt betrayed. He returned to Afghanistan and began speaking out against the Saudi regime. He also started funding the activities of Saudi dissidents in London. Then in 1992, bin Laden abruptly left Kabul for Sudan. In despair over the infighting among the various factions of the Mujahideen and convinced that the Saudis were scheming to kill him. He arrived in Khartoum with his 3 wives and 15 children. He went into business, investing heavily in Sudanese construction projects, including an airport and the country's main highway. He also bought up the entire crop of Sudanese cotton, and he occasionally picked up the tab for the country's oil imports. In those early days in Khartoum, bin Laden felt secure enough to walk to the mosque 5 times a day without his bodyguards. Zawahiri's relatives expected him to return to Egypt. Throughout the Soviet-Afghan War and for several years afterward, he continued to pay rent on his clinic in Mahdi, but he felt that it was not safe for him to return. Eventually, he followed bin Laden to Sudan. There he set about reorganizing al-Jihad. He gave a Sudanese mujahid named Jamal al-Fadl $250,000 to buy a farm north of the Sudan capital, where members of his organization could receive military training. Despite Zawahiri's close ties to bin Laden, money for al-Jihad was always in short supply. Many of Zawahiri's followers had families, and they all needed food and housing. A few turned to theft and shakedowns to support themselves. Zawahiri strongly disapproved of this. When members of al-Jihad robbed a German military attaché in Yemen, he investigated the incident and expelled those responsible. But the money problem remained. In the early 1990s, Zawahiri sent several of his followers to Albania to work for Muslim charities. They were expected to send 10% of their paychecks to al-Jihad, but it was a meager contribution. Zawahiri bristled at bin Laden's lack of support. "The young men are willing to give up their souls while the wealthy remain with money," he wrote in the Islamist magazine Kalimat Haq. Bin Laden, for his part, was continually frustrated by the conflict between the two principal Egyptian organizations and was increasingly unwilling to fund either of them. Zawahiri decided to look for money in the world center of venture capitalism, Silicon Valley. He had been to America once before, in 1989, when he paid a recruiting visit to the Mujahideen's Services Bureau branch office in Brooklyn. He returned in the spring of 1993, this time to Santa Clara, California, where he met Dr. Ali Zaki, a gynecologist and a prominent civic leader in San Jose. "He came as a representative of the Red Crescent of Kuwait," Zaki said. "I was also a physician, so they asked me to accompany him while he was here." Zaki escorted Zawahiri to mosques in Sacramento and Stockton. The two doctors spent most of their time discussing medical problems that Zawahiri encountered in Afghanistan. "We talked about the children and the farmers who were injured and were missing limbs because of all the Russian mines," Zaki recalled. He was a well-balanced, highly educated physician. But financially, the trip was not a success. Zaki estimated that at most, the donations produced by these visits to the California mosques amounted to several hundred dollars. Immediately after this dispiriting trip, Zawahiri began working more closely with bin Laden, and most of the Egyptian members of al-Jihad went on the al-Qaeda payroll. These men were not mercenaries. They were highly motivated idealists, many of whom had turned their backs on middle-class careers. Their wages were modest, about $100 a month for the average fighter, $200 for a skilled worker. They faced a difficult choice: whether to maintain their allegiance to a bootstrap organization that was always struggling financially, or to join forces with a wealthy Saudi who had long-standing ties to the oil billionaires in the Persian Gulf. Moreover, the two organizations had different goals. Al-Jihad's efforts were still concentrated on Egypt. Bin Laden, the businessman, sought to merge all Islamic terrorist groups into a single multinational corporation with departments devoted to everything from personnel to policymaking. Despite Al-Jihad's financial precariousness, many of its members were suspicious of Bin Laden and had no desire to divert their efforts outside Egypt. Zawahiri viewed the alliance as a marriage of convenience. One of his chief assistants, Ahmed al-Najjar, later testified in Cairo that Zawahiri had confided to him that joining with Bin Laden was the only solution to keeping the jihad organization alive. Sudan seemed an ideal spot from which to launch attacks on Egypt. The active cooperation of Sudan's intelligence agency and its military forces provided a safe harbor for the militants. The long, trackless, and almost entirely unguarded border between the two countries facilitated secret movements, and ancient caravan trails provided convenient routes for smuggling weapons and explosives into Egypt on the backs of camels. Iran supplied many of the weapons, and the Iranian-backed terrorist organization Hezbollah provided training in the use of explosives. Al-Jihad began its assault on Egypt with an attempt on the life of the interior minister, who was leading the crackdown on Islamic militants. In August of 1993, a bomb-laden motorcycle exploded next to the minister's car, killing the bomber and his accomplice. The minister escaped death, but his arm was broken, Zawahiri writes in his memoir. A pile of files that he kept next to him saved his life from the shrapnel. The following November, Zawahiri's men tried to kill Egypt's prime minister with a car bomb as he was being driven past a girls' school in Cairo. The bomb missed its target, but the explosion injured 21 people and killed a 12-year-old schoolgirl. Shema Abdel Halim, who was crushed by a door blown loose in the blast. Her death outraged Egyptians, who had seen more than 240 people killed by terrorists in the previous 2 years. As Shema's coffin was borne through the streets of Cairo, people cried, "Terrorism is the enemy of God." Zawahiri was shaken by the popular outrage. The unintended death of this innocent child pained us all, but we were helpless and we had to fight the government, which was against God's Sharia and supported God's enemies, he notes in his memoir. He offered what amounted to blood money to the girl's family. The Egyptian government arrested hundreds of his followers. Six were eventually given a sentence of death. Zawahiri writes, "This meant that they wanted my daughter, who was two at the time, and the daughters of other colleagues to be orphans, who cried or cared for our daughters." Zawahiri was a pioneer in the use of suicide bombers, which became a signature of Al-Jihad assassinations. The strategy broke powerful religious taboos against suicide and the murder of innocents. For these reasons, the Islamic group preferred to work with guns and knives. Although Hezbollah employed truck bombers to attack the American embassy and the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut in 1983, such martyrdom operations had not yet worked their way into the modern vocabulary of terror. In Palestine, suicide bombings were virtually unknown until the mid-90s, when the Oslo Accords began to unravel. Another of Zawahiri's innovations was to tape the bomber's vows of martyrdom on the eve of the mission. Obsessed with secrecy, Zawahiri imposed a blind cell structure on the jihad organization so that members in one group would not know the activities or personnel in another. Thus, a security breach in one cell should not compromise other units, and certainly not the entire organization. However, in 1993, Egyptian authorities arrested Al-Jihad's membership director, Ismail Nasir. He had a computer containing the entire database, Osama Rushdie, a former member of the Islamic group, told me. Where the member lived, which home he might be hiding in, even what names he uses with false passports. Supplied with this information, the Egyptian security forces pulled in 1,000 suspects and placed more than 300 of them on trial in military courts on charges of attempting to overthrow the government. The evidence was thin, but the judicial standards weren't very rigorous. It was all staged, Hisham Qasim, the publisher of the Cairo Times and the president of the Egyptian Organization for Human Rights, told me. The ones you think are dangerous, you hang. The rest, you give them life sentences. Both Al-Jihad and the Islamic group had been decimated by defections and arrests. The Islamic group's leader, Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, had emigrated to the United States and was arrested following the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. He and 9 followers were convicted in 1996 of conspiring to destroy New York landmarks, including the Lincoln and Holland tunnels, the Federal Building, and the United Nations headquarters. In April of 1995, Zawahiri chaired a meeting in Khartoum attended by the remaining members of the two organizations, along with representatives of other terrorist groups. They agreed on a spectacular act, the assassination of the Egyptian president, Hosni Mubarak. It was a dangerous bet for the Islamists. The attack was carried out in June in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, where Mubarak was on a state visit. There was a shootout between Mubarak's bodyguards and the assassins. 2 Ethiopian policemen were killed, but Mubarak escaped unharmed. The Egyptian government responded with a furious determination to finish off Al-Jihad. The security forces used exemplary punishment, Hisham Qasim told me. They torched houses in a village because a member of Jihad had come from there. A mother would be stripped naked in front of a guy who was told, "Next time we'll rape her if your younger brother is not here." A recently instituted anti-terrorism law had made it a crime even to express sympathy for terrorist movements. 5 new prisons were being built to house the thousands of suspects that were rounded up, many of whom were never charged. Zawahiri's response to the crackdown was to blow up the Egyptian embassy in Islamabad, Pakistan. On November 19, 1995, 2 cars filled with explosives crashed through the embassy gates, killing the bombers and 16 other people. 60 were wounded. This act of mass murder was Al-Jihad's first success under Zawahiri's administration. The bomb left the embassy's ruined building as an eloquent and clear message, Zawahiri boasts in his memoir. After the bombing of the embassy in Pakistan, Egyptian intelligence agents devised a fiendish plan. They lured a 13-year-old Egyptian boy, the son of a senior member of Al-Jihad in Sudan, into an apartment with the promise of juice and videos. The boy was drugged and sodomized. When he woke, he was confronted with photographs of the homosexual activity and threatened with the prospect of having them shown to his father. For the child, the consequences of such a disclosure were overwhelming. It could even be that the father would kill him, a source close to Zawahiri admitted. Egyptian intelligence forced the child to recruit another boy whose father was the treasurer for Al-Qaeda. That boy endured the same humiliating initiation of drugs and sexual abuse and was forced to turn against his own family. The agents taught the boys how to plant microphones in their own homes and photograph documents. A number of arrests followed because of the information provided by the boy spies. The Egyptian agents then decided to use the boys to kill Zawahiri. They gave one of them a suitcase filled with explosives, which he was to leave near a place where Zawahiri was expected to be. The plan failed when Sudanese intelligence agents and Al-Jihad security spotted the boy in the company of Egyptian embassy personnel. They arrested him while he was holding the suitcase. The Sudanese captured the other boy and put them both in jail. Hani al-Sibai, who has become a kind of historian of the Islamist movement, told me, "Most of the Islamic groups were in Sudan, so the rumors about the story were huge. The jihad organization considered the whole thing a scandal for them. Zawahiri went to the Sudanese authorities and asked that the boys be temporarily released from jail so that he could interrogate them. He promised to return them safely. The Sudanese, who were now addicted to bin Laden's financial generosity, agreed. Zawahiri convened an Islamic court, put the boys on trial for treason, convicted them, and had them shot. In a characteristic gesture, he made a tape of their confessions and had it distributed as a warning to others who might betray the organization." The Sudanese, furious at Zawahiri's duplicity, and also under intense pressure from the United States and Saudi Arabia to stop harboring terrorists, decided to expel Zawahiri and bin Laden and their followers. The Sudanese did not even give them time to pack. "All we did was to apply God's Sharia," Zawahiri complained. "If we fail to apply it to ourselves, then how can we apply it to others?" In Zawahiri's hands, Al-Jihad had splintered into angry and homeless gangs. There were fewer than 100 members left in the organization, now scattered throughout the region. "These are bad times," Zawahiri admitted in Yemen, where he had taken refuge. He confided to some of his colleagues that he was developing an ulcer. Zawahiri's next movements are unclear. He was tracked by Egyptian intelligence agents in Switzerland and Sarajevo, and he allegedly sought asylum in Bulgaria. An Egyptian newspaper reported that Zawahiri had gone to live in luxury in a Swiss villa near the French border, and that he had $30 million in a secret account. Zawahiri did claim on several occasions to have lived in Switzerland, but the Swiss say they have no evidence that he was ever in the country, much less that he was granted asylum. He turned up briefly in Holland, which does not have an extradition treaty with Egypt. He had talks there about establishing a satellite television channel backed by wealthy Arabs that would provide a fundamentalist alternative to the Al Jazeera network, which had recently been launched in Qatar. Zawahiri's plan was to broadcast 10 hours a day to Europe and the Middle East, using only male presenters. Nothing came of the idea. A memo that Zawahiri later wrote to his colleagues, it was recovered from an Al-Qaeda computer obtained by a Wall Street Journal reporter after the fall of the Taliban, reveals that in December of 1996, he was on his way to Chechnya to establish a new home base for the remnants of Al-Jihad. "Conditions there were excellent," he wrote in the memo. The Russians had begun to withdraw from Chechnya earlier that year after achieving a ceasefire with the rebellious region. To the Islamists, Chechnya offered an opportunity to create an Islamic Republic in the Caucasus, from which they could wage jihad throughout Central Asia. Soon after Zawahiri and two of his top lieutenants, Ahmad Salama Mabruk and Mahmoud Hisham al-Hanawi, crossed into the Russian province of Dagestan, they were arrested for entering the country illegally. The Russians discovered, among other documents, false identity papers, including a Sudanese passport that Zawahiri sometimes used. Zawahiri's passport indicated that he had been to Yemen 4 times, Malaysia 3 times, Singapore 2 times, and China, probably Taiwan, 1 time. All within the previous 20 months. The Russians were never able to discover their real identities. At the trial, in April 1997, Zawahiri insisted that he had come to Russia to find out the price for leather, medicine, and other goods. He said he was unaware that he was crossing the border illegally. The judge sentenced the three men to 6 months in jail. They had nearly completed the term by the time of the trial, and the following month they were released. Once again, his disgruntled followers chastised him for his carelessness. An email from colleagues in Yemen referred to the Russia adventure as a disaster that almost destroyed the group. This fiasco had a profound consequence. With even more defectors from his membership and no real sources of income, Zawahiri had no choice but to rejoin bin Laden, who had moved his base to Kandahar. Pakistani intelligence had persuaded the Taliban to return the al-Qaeda camps in Khost and elsewhere to bin Laden's control in order to train militants to fight in Kashmir. Despite the still dire financial circumstances, Zawahiri believed that his fortunes were better served with bin Laden than without him. Bin Laden had had enough of the fighting between the Egyptian factions. He told members of al-Jihad that their ineffectual operations in Egypt were too expensive, and that it was time for them to turn their guns on the United States and Israel. On August 23, 1996, bin Laden issued an edict entitled Declaration of War Against the Americans Occupying the Land of the Two Holy Places. Everyone agrees that the shadow of a stick cannot be straightened as long as the stick is crooked, he writes. Hence, it is imperative to focus on attacking the main enemy. He argues that the West deliberately divided the Muslim world into states and mini-states, which could be easily controlled. He declares, "There is no higher priority after faith than pushing back the American-Israeli alliance." He calls upon all Muslims to participate in jihad in order to liberate Saudi Arabia and restore the dignity of the Islamic community. In view of the enemy's strength, fast and light forces must be used and must operate in absolute secrecy. Zawahiri formally sealed his new alliance with bin Laden on February 23, 1998, when his name appeared as one of the signatories on a document published in the London newspaper Al-Quds Al-Arabi. The document announced the formation of the International Islamic Front for Jihad on the Jews and Crusaders. "In compliance with God's order," the text read, "we issue the following fatwa to all Muslims. The ruling to kill the Americans and their allies, civilian and military, is an individual duty for every Muslim who can do it in any country in which it is possible to do it." Included in the alliance were jihad groups in Afghanistan, Sudan, Saudi Arabia, Somalia, Yemen, Eritrea, Djibouti, Kenya, Pakistan, Bosnia, Croatia, Algeria, Tunisia, Lebanon, the Philippines, Tajikistan, Chechnya, Bangladesh, Kashmir, Azerbaijan, and Palestine. The document gave the West its first glimpse of the worldwide conspiracy that was beginning to form. Since the early 90s, Egyptian authorities had felt stymied in their efforts to stamp out Islamic fundamentalists by the protection that Western governments afforded fugitives. The Egyptians complained that more than 500 terrorists had found refuge in England, France, Germany, Austria, Denmark, Belgium, Holland, and the United States, among other countries, on the grounds that they would be subjected to political persecution and perhaps torture if they were sent home. Many European governments refused to return a suspect to face a trial in which he might receive the death penalty. But the formation of the Islamic Front and its call for a fatwa against Americans and their allies prompted a new vigilance in the West. The CIA, which had sporadically tried to keep track of al-Jihad over the years, acted quickly. In July of 1998, American agents kidnapped Ahmad Salama Mabruk and another member of Jihad outside a restaurant in Baku, Azerbaijan. Mabruk's laptop computer turned out to contain vital information about Jihad members in Europe. The same summer, the CIA moved against an al-Jihad cell in Tirana, Albania. The cell, with 16 members, had been created by Zawahiri's brother Muhammad in the early 90s. Albanian agents, under CIA supervision, kidnapped 5 members of the cell, blindfolded them, interrogated them for several days, and then sent the Egyptian members to Cairo. They were put on trial with more than 100 other suspected terrorists. Their lawyer, Hafiz Abu Saada, maintains that they were tortured. The ordeal produced 20,000 pages of confessions, and both Zawahiri brothers were given death sentences in absentia. On August 6th, a month after the breakup of the Albanian cell, Zawahiri sent the following declaration to a London-based Arabic paper. "We are interested in briefly telling the Americans that their message has been received, and that the response, which we hope they will read carefully, is being prepared, because, with God's help, we will write it in the language that they understand." The following day, simultaneous suicide bombings destroyed the American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. 223 people died, and more than 5,000 were injured. American intelligence officials were stunned by the extent of the devastation in East Africa, and they were amazed by the skill with which the bombings were carried out. The level of planning and coordination indicated that the bombers had a new degree of sophistication, as well as a willingness to raise the stakes in terms of innocent lives. On August 20th, President Clinton ordered an attack on bin Laden's training camps in Afghanistan, and also on a pharmaceutical plant in Sudan that was thought to be manufacturing a precursor to the lethal nerve gas VX. American warships in the region fired 79 Tomahawk cruise missiles into Afghanistan and Sudan. A subsequent investigation established that the plant in Sudan was making ibuprofen and veterinary medicines, not poison gas. The strike killed a night watchman. In Afghanistan, the attack failed to hit its main targets, bin Laden, Zawahiri, and the other al-Qaeda leaders. The strikes, which in the big-chested parlance of military planners were dubbed Operation Infinite Reach, cost American taxpayers $79 million. But they merely exposed the inadequacy of American intelligence. President Clinton later explained that one of the strikes had been aimed at a gathering of key terrorist leaders, but the meeting in question had occurred a month earlier. According to Russian intelligence sources, cited in Al-Majalla, an Arabic magazine in London, bin Laden sold the Tomahawk missiles that failed to explode to China for more than $10 million, which he then used to finance operations in Chechnya. The failure of Operation Infinite Reach established bin Laden as a legendary figure, not just in the Muslim world, but wherever America, with the clamor of its narcissistic culture and the presence of its military forces, had made itself unwelcome. When bin Laden's voice came crackling across a radio transmission, "By the grace of God, I am alive," the forces of anti-Americanism had found their champion. Those who had objected to the slaughter of innocents in the embassies in East Africa, many of whom were Muslims, were cowed by the popular response to this man, whose defiance of America now seemed blessed by divine favor. The day after the strikes, Zawahiri called a reporter in Karachi with a message. "Tell the Americans that we aren't afraid of bombardment, threats, and acts of aggression. We suffered and survived the Soviet bombings for 10 years in Afghanistan, and we are ready for more sacrifices. The war has only just begun. The Americans should now await the answer."